Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson. The first installment in this series summarized Chief Justice John Marshall's early life and his contributions to the adoption of the Constitution. The second installment examined his career as an envoy to France, member of Congress, and Secretary of State. The third focused on his decisions in Marbury versus Madison and McCulloch versus Maryland. It concluded that those decisions do not support the common view that Marshall was an early model for liberal judicial activism. This final part four discusses two more of Marshall's leading cases and summarizes the remainder of his life. First, the 1824 decision in Gibbons versus Ogden. As in the two earlier cases reviewed, Marshall spoke for a unanimous court in Gibbons versus Ogden. Two rulings were central to the case. First, the Constitution's grant to Congress of power to regulate interstate commerce included authority to regulate interstate navigation. And second, a congressional law regulating interstate navigation prevailed over an inconsistent state law on the subject. Marshall was not being creative by including navigation within Congress's commerce power. The founding era record shows that he was saying no more than the truth. Regulating navigation always had been understood as a portion of regulating commerce. Some have suggested that Gibbons versus Ogden gave Congress authority to control any activity affecting commerce. The Supreme Court adopted this position in Wickard versus Filburn in 1942, and it's become a constitutional pretext for much of the federal administrative state. But this suggestion overlooks some important language in Marshall's opinion in Gibbons versus Ogden. The overlooked language is the Chief Justice's argument that inspection laws are a matter for the states alone, not for the federal government. He wrote, quote, "that inspection laws may have a remote and considerable influence on commerce will not be denied, but that a power to regulate commerce is the source from which the right to pass them is derived cannot be admitted. Inspection laws act upon the subject before it becomes an article of foreign commerce or of commerce among the states, and prepare it for that purpose. They form a portion of that immense mass of legislation which embraces everything within the territory of a state not surrendered to the general government. Inspection laws, quarantine laws, health laws of every description, as well as laws for regulating the internal commerce of a state, and those which respect turnpike roads, ferries, etc., are component parts of this mass. No direct power over these objects is granted to Congress." End quote. Notice that in this passage, Marshall specifically rejected the idea that because an activity affects commerce, or in his words, has a considerable influence on interstate commerce, that the feds can therefore regulate it. Notice also that Marshall would have considered federal health laws, such as Obamacare, to be unconstitutional. Gibbons' other important holding was that a federal navigation statute overrode an inconsistent state statute. Because the federal law was within Congress's power, this result necessarily follows under the supremacy rule in the Constitution's Article 6. The next case is Worcester versus Georgia of 1832. Chief Justice Marshall's opinion in Worcester versus Georgia sometimes is used to buttress the dubious claim that the Constitution grants Congress, as against the states, plenary and exclusive authority over Indian affairs. Thus, in the 2023 case of Holland versus Brackeen, the Supreme Court relied partly on Worcester versus Georgia to sustain congressional control over Indian child placement. This plenary and exclusive claim is patently false, and Marshall's opinion in Worcester versus Georgia does not support it. It is true that that case correctly upheld federal authority over the Cherokee Indians at the expense of the state of Georgia. But this was not because of a power given to the federal government by the Constitution. It was because of specific treaties between the United States and the Cherokee. Marshall, like other founders, understood that a treaty could give the federal government some authority it otherwise would not have. But Worcester versus Georgia is irrelevant to federal laws, such as the one at issue in Holland versus Brackeen, which apply to Indians other than the Cherokee. Moreover, as Marshall emphasized, even the Cherokee treaties granted Congress no power to regulate internal Indian affairs. As is true of other efforts to enlist Marshall in the cause of the liberal judicial project, Worcester versus Georgia does not justify the decision in Holland versus Brackeen. Politicians, lawyers, and members of the general public frequently argue about how the Constitution should be interpreted. Phrases like strict construction, liberal construction, precedent, original meaning, and living constitution are tossed around, often with little real understanding of their definitions. To add to the conclusion, law professors invent what they call interpretive theories, tailored to give them the political results they favored. I'm reminded of the quip in Robert Heinlein's novel, Methuselah's Children, quote, "He wants what he wants when he wants it, and thinks that constitutes a natural law," end quote. Unfortunately, that describes the views of many law professors. However, the Constitution's framers wrote the document on the understanding that it would be read according to the then prevailing legal rules. Had they expected it to be interpreted by other rules, they doubtless would have worded the Constitution differently. When the Constitution was adopted, the principal prevailing rule for interpreting a text was to seek what was called the intent of the makers. In the case of a constitution, the makers were the ratifiers. Today we call this standard of looking at how the ratifiers understood things original understanding. If you could not find the maker's intent, then you construed the document according to how they probably understood it, that is, according to how a reasonable person would have understood it at the time of adoption. Today we call this process original meaning. When Marshall wrote, there was no comprehensive collection of the ratification debates that occurred between 1787 and 1790. Not even James Madison's notes from the Constitutional Convention had been published yet. Nor was there much case precedent on the Constitution itself. The lack often forced Marshall to focus on the document's text alone without additional guides to finding the intent of the makers. Still, he acknowledged that, quote, "the great duty of a judge who construes an instrument is to find the intention of its makers," end quote. Focusing on intention ruled out construing the document either too narrowly or too broadly. Again, here's what Marshall had to say. "There is certainly a medium between that restricted sense which confines the meaning of words to narrower limits than the common understanding of the world affixes to them, and that extended sense which would stretch them beyond their obvious import. There is a fair construction which gives to language the sense in which it is used and interprets an instrument according to its true intention." Marshall always stuck with this fair construction ideal. Some who attempt to paint the lanky Virginian as a proto-liberal activist point out that in Marbury versus Madison, he wrote, "We must never forget that it is a constitution we are expounding." By that sentence, however, Marshall did not mean that the maker's intention should be disregarded and the Constitution rendered malleable. On the contrary, that language, "We must never forget that it's a constitution we're expounding," that language was part of his explanation that the precise procedure for finding the intent of the makers of a constitution differs somewhat from the procedure for finding the intent of the makers of a statute or of a contract. But the underlying goal was precisely the same, to apply the document as its makers understood it, not in any other way. John Marshall remained on the Supreme Court until his death, yet there was more to his life than the court. Between 1804 and 1807, he authored a 5-volume biography of George Washington. He later composed an abridged second edition. He was always physically vigorous, so in 1812, he led a Virginia survey expedition to the falls of the Kanawha River, deep into what is now West Virginia. He spent his summer vacations in the mountains, but when not in the mountains or in the nation's capital, he was a feature of life in Richmond, Virginia. He retained the common touch and enjoyed mixing with others. His biographer, Charles F. Hobson, reports, quote, "A frequent sight in Richmond was the Chief Justice, basket in hand, doing the family marketing," end quote. At the age of 74, he served in the Virginia Constitutional Convention, along with Presidents James Madison and James Monroe. He lived until he was 79 years of age, finally passing on July 6, 1835. His home in Richmond, Virginia, is preserved for public view. I'm Rob Nadelson, and thanks for listening.